You have a worldview. I have a worldview. Everyone has a worldview. A worldview is a particular way of looking and seeing life and the world in which we live. You know, it shapes both the way we think and the way we live. Just to help us better understand what a worldview is, let me share a few definitions or descriptions to help us, you know, get a more rounded concept of worldview. A worldview is a comprehensive view of life through which we think, understand, and judge, and which determines our approach to life and meaning. That's very helpful. You know, a worldview is a basic set of assumptions that gives meaning to one's thoughts. A worldview is a set of assumptions that someone has about the way things are, about what things are, about why things are. And this is my particular favorite, although it's second to last, but anyway, I'll switch it someday. A worldview is a set of presuppositions, assumptions which may be true, partially true, or entirely false. Okay, this is what I like about this stuff. This is a really good definition. It's a worldview is a set of presuppositions which we hold consciously or subconsciously, consistently or inconsistently. This is a very realistic definition of worldview, especially in our times, about the basic makeup of our world. So in other words, we don't have to, our worldview doesn't have to be consistent. I mean, what's the fun in that? You know, it doesn't have to be true, you know. False news is good enough for my worldview. Thank you very much. The last one. Our worldview is perhaps best reflected by one's answer to the ultimate questions of life. Who am I? Why am I here? Where am I going? What's it all about? Is there a God? How can I live and die happily? What are good and evil? What would I be willing to die for? That's an interesting one. You know, we live in a post-Christian context with an increasingly non-Christian and secular worldview, at least in this part of the world. You know, this has created a cultural war that seeks to promote a singular mindset that must not only be agreed to, but celebrated. For many driving the cultural shift, there's no room for differing opinions or debate because the debate is over and there's only one opinion that matters, theirs. I realize I'm generalizing, there's always exceptions, but ultimately I believe I'm fair in describing the spirit of our age, or at least the movers and the shakers that are driving the spirit of our age. And the question is, what are we as followers of Christ to do about it? How are we to cope with the shifting sand of change? Do we fight back? Do we get with the program and change with the times? Is there room for compromise? And if so, how would that look? Are there hills for us to die on? If so, what exactly are they? These are not easy questions to answer or to dance to. Ultimately, we must remain faithful to Yahweh and to live in a way that honors Him. We're called to be obedient to His will, but how do we do that in a world that's hostile to that will? How do we have faith in a hostile world? How do we have hope in a hostile world? Today we begin a new series of messages entitled Hope in a Hostile World that will take us through the book of Daniel. You see, Daniel and his buddies lived in a hostile culture that, much like our present culture, sought to shape their worldview into something new. They lived in a culture that sought to erase any notion of Yahweh or any part of their identity that was associated with their faith in Yahweh. They sought to completely remove that from their mindsets. How did they resist this onslaught, this intentional programming, so to speak? Did they succeed in holding on to their identity as God's people? Did they remain faithful? Most of you probably already know the answer to that question, but don't get ahead of yourselves. You know, Daniel is the top of the Sunday school ladder. And that has advantages and it has disadvantages for us. If you're teaching children, you don't get better material than lions and fiery furnaces. You know, that's it. You don't have to do anything. You just have to, you know, set things on fire and bring lions in and everybody's happy. Most of us have heard and sung the song, Dare to be a Daniel. But in all of the Sunday school Dare to be a Daniel approaches, more often than not, we just skim across the surface and grab at what seems obvious about Daniel. But we really don't grasp most of the time Daniel's intended message. To be honest with you, Daniel's one of those books that most preachers mangle because it's so easy just to jump the gun and preach, be like Daniel, the end. You know, be what he is, do what his friends do. That's the message of Daniel, but it's not. Daniel and his friends are clearly heroes, and we're encouraged to emulate them. But that's not the main message of Daniel. It's part of it, but it's not the main message. And how exactly do we emulate them? There's a good question. You know, is it by doing what they do? Stop eating meat. Some sermons say that. That's a mangled sermon. Is it by doing what they do, or is it by believing like they believe? Or is it like trusting like they trust? Or is it all of the above? The point I'm trying to make is that Daniel is much more nuanced of a book than what you might think at first. It's a difficult book to correctly interpret and apply. But if we make the effort and if we take the time, there's so much that a study of Daniel gives us in our present culture today. It's so much that it speaks to about our present culture today. And in the challenges that we face as Christians in an increasingly hostile culture, it's so now, so relevant. Okay, is everyone excited? Do we want to dig into Daniel?
Yes.
It's either Daniel or Leviticus. Choose now. While you're deciding, let's turn to Daniel page, Daniel chapter 1, page 747. 747. Daniel page 1. Or Daniel chapter 1, page 747. Let me give you a bit of background as you turn there. The book of Daniel has two distinct halves. It's quite a unique book in many ways. It has two distinct halves. The first is a series of six stories about Daniel and his three friends. And each one of these six stories is kind of a self-contained unit that could stand on their own. It's like six short stories, in a way. And the second half of the book contains four apocalyptic visions. Apocalyptic literature like Daniel or the book of Revelation are produced by those who are oppressed. Daniel was written by Jews suffering in exile in Babylon. Revelation was written by and for persecuted Christians. That's the kind of activity and background that produces apocalyptic literature. Apocalyptic is a style of literature written for those who feel marginalized and left out. It's for those who are ridiculed for their faith. It's for anyone who feels burnt out and tired and who wonders if life is passing them by. Stop me when this applies to you. It's for all who grieve. Who don't get out of life what they expected. It's for those who are frustrated and angry. Basically, then, apocalyptic literature is written for those who need some perspective. Apocalyptic addresses the imagination because those in exile need something more than words. Words are not enough to grab their hearts and give them the courage to endure. Sometimes you need images for the imagination to cling to. Images that point beyond this world and beyond the immediate forces that seem to be controlling our lives. Sometimes we need images of the big picture, of the unseen realm to hold on to. This is what we have in the second half of Daniel. And these images were not just to give hope to those who were in exile in Babylon. They were. But they were also images that Jesus felt particularly connected to and identified with. And you cannot understand who Jesus thought he was and who Jesus was, actually was, if you don't understand how he claims the book of Daniel for himself. That should excite you right there, just that one little thing. There are also images that John interacts with extensively in Revelation. Daniel's a potent little book. But even though there's these two distinctive halves to Daniel, it isn't just straightforward as part one and part two. It isn't simply six exciting stories and then four crazy dreams. There's a connection between the six stories in the first half and the visions of the second half. So the two halves of Daniel play off one another, and both are needed to understand the full message of the book. For example, in chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar has an apocalyptic dream of himself, and there's this colossal statue with four different metals symbolizing four successive kingdoms. This vision connects to the first of the apocalyptic visions in chapter 7. In which Daniel sees four strange beasts symbolizing the four successive kingdoms. And there's far more interplay going on between the two sections. And that makes Daniel a unified whole. Daniel is also the only book in the Old Testament that contains original material written in Aramaic. We have a couple of letters, and we have one comment that was originally quoted in Aramaic and a few other places, but this is the only time we have original material written in Aramaic in the Old Testament. As a matter of fact, about half of Daniel is in Aramaic. Aramaic was the language of Babylon, and it continued to be the language of the empire until the ancient world was Hellenized under Alexander the Great. And this is the language of the court of Nebuchadnezzar. The use of Aramaic speaks to the authenticity of the book of Daniel as a document written in exile in the 6th century BC. Now, Daniel 1 is really an introduction to the entire book, and it sets the stage for all the main themes and the purposes of the book. Let's get into Daniel, beginning with verse 1. Keep your finger there, because we'll be referring back to this passage from time to time. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles of the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia and put them in the treasury house of his God. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of his court officials, to bring in some of the Israelites from the royal family and nobility. Let's stop there. Daniel begins with a bang. Judah, the southern kingdom, has been in political and spiritual decline for quite some time. In 605 BC, during the reign of Jehoiakim, one of the worst kings of Judah, which says a lot, certainly nothing, you know, like his father. He is delivered to Nebuchadnezzar. King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon attacks Jerusalem. We read in 2 Chronicles of this event, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, attacked him and bound him with bronze shackles to take him to Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar also took to Babylon articles from the temple of the Lord and put them in his temple there. But here in Daniel, we're given the reason for this humiliating defeat. This happened not because Nebuchadnezzar was bigger or had a bigger sword or had more people. This happened because the Lord delivered King Jehoiakim of Judah into his hand, along with some of the articles of the temple. Immediately, we're introduced to the fact that Yahweh is behind this exile. Wow. Surprise! Babylon was a terrifying world power. Nebuchadnezzar was a powerful king. But what happened to Jehoiakim in Jerusalem wasn't as simple as the nation of the most power winning. No, what happened was directly attributed to the sovereign Lord of Israel. From the very start, we see the reality is quite different than the reality we experience or see. On the surface of things, these articles taken from the temple were taken as a trophy. They were transported to Babylon and placed in the house of the pagan god in Babylon, probably Marduk, the chief god of the Babylonians. And this was their way of saying, our God is better and stronger than your God. We can't imagine how devastating and confusing that would have been to God's people. Last time something like that happened was with the Philistines, when they placed the Ark of the Covenant in the temple of Dagon. To the Philistines, it appeared that Dagon had defeated Yahweh. But what happens after that quickly changes their minds. If you know the story, you know, with the statue of Dagon being toppled and his head falling off and his hands falling off and people being inflicted with tumors. The Ark was passed from city to city. They called it the tumor tour. Until finally the Ark was put on a cart and God directed the Ark back to his own people. The Philistines found out who had the most powerful God. But this time Marduk remained standing. He kept his hands in his head. This time there was no plagues. This time he always seemed defeated. It seemed that God had left his people. But the truth was that Yahweh wasn't defeated, Yahweh was in control. The Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. In verse 3 we read, then the king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of his court officials, to bring in some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility. In all, there would be 3 deportations of people from Israel to Babylon. In 605, 597, and then 586. But the question is, why? Why did Yahweh hand God's people over to Babylon? By the way, Daniel and his friends are in this first section, this first deportation. Well, in Deuteronomy chapter 28, 29, and 30 are key to understanding Daniel and what's going on in Daniel. Good place to do some additional reading. In Deuteronomy, the Lord has warned his people that if they disobey him, curses would come on them. For example, Deuteronomy 28, 15. However, if you do not obey, again, the context here is they're just about to enter the promised land. Moses is just kind of saying the final words. He's retelling the law. He's giving them all the information they need to have in order to have either a successful life in the promised land or to have a not so successful life. So this becomes a warning that they're given before they even enter the land. However, if you do not obey the Lord your God and do not carefully follow all his commands and decrees I'm giving you today, all these curses will come upon you and overtake you. Then if you jump down to verse 25, we read, the Lord will cause you to be defeated before your enemies. You will come at them from one direction, but flee from them in 7, and you will become a thing of horror to all the kingdoms of the earth. Ooh. I wonder what he's getting at there. Then in verse 64, same chapter, then the Lord will scatter you among all nations from one end of the earth to the other. There you will worship other gods, gods of wood and stone, which neither you nor your fathers have known. God wasn't defeated. God wasn't absent. God was acting. He was keeping his promise because God's people had turned away from him. And Daniel and his friends were among the first wave of people who were taken to Babylon. But Daniel and his friends weren't the problem. They were the cream of the crop. We're told that they were royal or at least noble birth. The Jewish Rabbis felt that they were actually relatives to King Hezekiah. They were the cream of the crop from Jerusalem. They were the most promising prospects. Why were they taken? Well, a brain drain of sorts. The idea was to take the best leaders with the greatest potential away from your enemy and use them to help with increasing governing responsibilities and to remove any threat that they might have in creating an uprising back home. Carrying on in verse 3. Again, then the king ordered Ashpenaz, king or chief of his court officials, to bring in some of the Israelites from the royal family and nobility. Young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, qualified to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and the literature of the Babylonians. The king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that, they were to enter into the king's service. And among these were some from Judah: Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. The chief officials gave them new names. To Daniel, the name Belshazzar; to Hananiah, Shadrach; to Mishael, Meshach; and to Azariah, Abednego. They could go. Kind of wish he kept his first name. Here we have the beginning of cultural pressure. They were going to be indoctrinated in the ways of the Babylonian culture. They were going to Babylonian school for 3 years. Anything that pointed them back to being worshippers of Yahweh was going to be systematically suppressed. So for 3 years they would be trained in the things of Babylon. They would be educated in all the thoughts and the ideas and the wisdom of the culture. And in the process learn to think and interact as a Babylonian. This involved being acquainted with polytheistic writings and occult practices and astrology and divination and magic. And all these things were forbidden in Israel, but they weren't in Israel anymore, were they? And this is what's behind the change of their names as well. Their religious identity was being removed by the changing of their names. They were now to be identified with the spirit of the age, with the gods of the culture. Azariah, which means Yahweh is my help, becomes Abednego, which means servant of Nob, or Niob, I should say. Niob was a key god in the pantheon of the Babylonians, and this was such a heinous god in connection as far as the Jews were concerned that in the book of Daniel it's changed. And instead of a B, we have a G changing it. So kind of a way of making fun of this god. Hananiah, which means Yahweh is gracious, becomes Shadrach, which means commander of a coup, another Babylonian god. The Assyrian moon god, actually, is what a coup is. Mishael, which means who is what God is. You know, God's unique, in other words, becomes Meshach, who is what Aku is, right? And Daniel, which means my judge, God judges, becomes Belshazzar, protector of the king. Someone once said, the names you allow to label you often title the script you live by. The names you allow to label you often title the script you live by. This name change is all about changing their identities to reflect what the culture wanted them to become. And to reject what they no longer wanted them to be. We live in a world where people want to live their own truth. And one of the ways they live their own truth is by changing their identities. Identity is a powerful thing. The Babylonians knew that. So they wanted anything that identified these young men with their identity as followers of Yahweh to be stripped away and replaced with the gods and the king of Babylon. So far we've seen the culture seeks to take away our hero's faith and identity as followers of Yahweh. Through education, through the changing of their names, and Daniel and the boys go along with it. Surprisingly. Or maybe not. But then continuing in verse 8 we read, "But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine. And he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself this way." Now God had caused the official to show favor and sympathy to Daniel. Let's stop there for a second. This is the second mention of God's activity in Daniel. First he handed over King Jehoiakim to Nebuchadnezzar. Now he causes the official to show favor and sympathy towards Daniel. God has a plan, God has a purpose, and God is going to use Daniel and his friends. God is going to use this seemingly hopeless situation to bring about his own will, which will culminate in the sending of his son Jesus. Continuing on with verse 10. "But the official told Daniel, 'I'm afraid of my lord the king, who has assigned your food and drink. Why should he see you looking worse than the other young men your age? The king would then have my head because of you.' Daniel then said to the guard whom the chief official had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, 'Please test your servants for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then compare our appearance with that of the young men who eat at the royal food and treat your servants in accordance with what you see.' So he agreed to this and tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished, fatter in the Hebrew, than any of the young men who ate the royal food. So the guard took away their choice food and wine, probably kept it for himself, and gave them vegetables and water instead. To these 4 young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning. And Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds." Now, exactly why Daniel draws the line in the sand with royal food isn't an easy question to answer. I mean, there's no sign of him resisting his education. 3 years of indoctrination? Or the changing of his name? That's pretty personal. You would think these things would be more of an issue, but they weren't. You might think this simply had to do with Daniel wanting to eat kosher meals and not break the Jewish food laws. But Jewish food laws didn't prohibit the drinking of wine unless you had taken a Nazarite vow. So that doesn't quite fit. Maybe the problem was that Daniel would have been troubled by eating food that was first offered to idols. The problem with that is Daniel does not avoid all the food from the palace. He does eat the vegetables, and we have no reason to think that the vegetables weren't also offered to the gods, along with the meat and drink. There's also a hint that the diet of vegetables was a temporary thing, because Daniel later on implies that he enjoyed much rich food in his life. So what exactly is going on here, and what's the reason for Daniel's decision? It's not clear. This is one of those places that we can easily be distracted from the message of Daniel. We take Daniel's stand on this one issue and we say, oh, it's all about health and balance. But that's not the point at all. This passage isn't in Daniel to give us diet tips and to write books to make money on the Daniel diet. The point is actually quite the opposite. The expected outcome of eating the vegetables only was that they wouldn't be as healthy or as strong as those who were eating the king's diet. So the fact that they're thriving doesn't point to a superior Daniel diet. As a matter of fact, the Daniel diet is what you eat to lose weight. And that's not what they're supposed to be doing here. They're supposed to be strong and gaining weight. That's what was looked at as being healthy in that culture. No, the point is that Daniel and his friends prospered even though they weren't taking advantage of the king's table. That's the point. Their well-being wasn't dependent on a better diet. It was dependent on a faithful God. This was God's miraculous provision for them. Not that it was a better diet. Brussels sprouts will never beat bacon. Unless you put them together, then they're really good. Here's what I think's happening. Daniel and his three friends are in the process of being educated and prepared for service. Their minds are, as well as their bodies, are being fed by the Babylonian court. So the question then becomes, you know, if they prosper, to whom should they be thanking for their success? The only answer is the Babylonians, right? But if they refuse to eat the food of the king, they know it's not the king who's responsible for the fact that they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. Their robust appearance, usually attained by rich fare of meat and wine, is miraculously achieved through a diet of vegetables. Only God could have done that. In other words, don't try that at home. Just joking. If you're a vegetarian, I'm just joking. So I think the purpose behind the request was something to do with what would help these four pious Judeans continue to believe in their God. Believing that their physical appearance was a gift, not of the Babylonian culture, but instead of their God, was what they needed at that moment in time. It was the needed evidence of God's sustaining presence in their lives when there really wasn't anything else that they could put their finger on. They needed, so to speak, to know that man does not live by bread alone, or in this case, vegetables, but by God, by the word of God, by the power of God. Another point we need to make here is that, you know, this diet was private. As these four stood before Nebuchadnezzar, in a few verses we haven't looked at yet, they're pronounced best in class, 10 times better than anyone else. The king could take pride in the products of his system. No one was the wiser. Daniel didn't stand up, "Hey, wait a minute, we haven't been eating from your table." Only Daniel and the boys knew the truth. They kept it to themselves. Notice that the nowhere is the diet made public. Daniel doesn't write a blog or publish a book. There's no food strikes. Daniel just quietly approaches the chief official and asks for his permission to change his diet. The chief officials didn't agree with them at first and refused to participate in the plan. But then verse 9 tells us that God had caused the officials to show favor and sympathy to Daniel. In the Hebrew, this is the same verb that's used in verse 2. God gave. God gave. So Daniel turns to the guard whom the chief official put in charge of their diet. Verse 11. He proposes this brief 10-day experiment, test. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink, and then after 10 days, compare our appearance. See what happens. Let's just give this a shot. If 10 days isn't enough to kill us, right? We know the test worked, and Daniel and his friends would be reminded every day that they were prospering by the hands of Yahweh, not King Nebuchadnezzar. It was a daily reminder that God was with them, watching over them, helping them. That even though they were depriving themselves, God was sustaining them. Okay, but why did Daniel pick this point to stand against the culture? You know, given the fact that God prepared his servant to be kind to Daniel, I think it's possible that God prompted Daniel to make this the place to dig in and to hold on his faith. You know, let's face it, they were captives. They were exiles. They didn't have a lot of freedom. They didn't have a lot of options. But God gives them something. A daily reminder of his presence. Something practical. You know, they could not eat without thinking about God. And understanding that it was God who actually made their request happen in the first place. And how it was God that prospered their health through a diet that shouldn't really have sustained them. Let's look at verse 17. To these four young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and language and learning. And Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. This is the third time we have God at work. Who is it that makes them excel in all their studies? Is it a superior Babylon education? The UFB? No, it's God. And in addition, we're also told that Daniel could understand visions. This points us into the next chapter, where that skill is needed. But it also connects Daniel with Joseph. You need to encourage your people in a difficult time. Let's look at Joseph. Like Joseph, Daniel is in exile in a foreign land, a land that he did not choose. Like Joseph, Daniel is going to influence this pagan kingdom and bring glory to God. The point for the saints who read this in exile was that they would understand that God was there, that God was at work, that others might have meant this for harm, but God used it for good. God had a purpose, and he could use it if they were faithful to him. The outcome is recorded in the beginning of verse 18. Beginning with verse 18. At the end of their time, set by the king to bring them in, the chief officials presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them, and he found no one equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's service. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his own kingdom. And Daniel remained there until the first year of King Cyrus. That's how the chapter ends. Daniel would outlive Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel would outlive the Babylonian Empire. He would see the return of the exile. Daniel and his friends became useful instruments in a pagan kingdom. And in so doing, they glorified God and they gave hope to their people. They did it not by protesting or arguing, but by serving. And yes, there will be times when personal faith will mean persecution and trials for them. Serious trials. They required serious faith. But nowhere does Daniel try to turn Babylon into Israel. He just tries to remain faithful to Yahweh and to be a good citizen of the exile. Martin Lloyd-Jones once made this comment about trying to legislate Christian morality. He says, the New Testament is never interested in conduct and behavior in itself. I can go further and say that the New Testament does not make an appeal for good behavior to anyone but to Christian people. The New Testament is not interested as such in morality of the world. It tells us quite plainly that you can't expect, or you can expect nothing from the world but sin. And that in its fallen condition, it's incapable of anything else. In Titus 3:3, Paul tells us that we were all once like that, for we ourselves were sometimes foolish, disobedient, deceived, serving diverse lusts and pleasures, living in malice and envy, hateful and hating one another. Thus, there is nothing according to the New Testament that is so factious and so utterly futile as to turn to such people and appeal to them to live the Christian life. The truth is, it only has one message for people like that, the message of repentance. We have to be reminded of that from time to time. The only change we can legislate is the change that comes from sharing the gospel. It's the change that we promote ourselves, the change we are obedient to ourselves, You know, when it comes to sharing the gospel and loving people into the kingdom by remaining faithful to Christ and his calling on our lives, that's where we're to be. It's about our own personal innocence and integrity. It's not about winning battles. It's about loving people. But having said that, Jesus does tell his disciples, I'm sending you out like sheep among wolves. Yay. Therefore, be as shrewd as snakes and as innocent as doves. We're sent. We're not to hide. We're not to isolate ourselves. We are not only to be sheep, but we're to be sheep among wolves. If you don't know any wolves, go find some. But that doesn't mean that we're to be stupid about it. I tried to come up with a better word than stupid, and I was too stupid to come up with it. So. It doesn't mean we're supposed to be stupid about it, right? We're to be shrewd and innocent. You don't think those two things go together, but they do. Shrewd and innocent as we live out the issues of our faith in our culture. Isn't that what Daniel is? Daniel was innocent and he was shrewd. He was kind and respectful to his captors. He had the shrewd approach. He was innocent. He wasn't pointing fingers. He wasn't being aggressive. He wasn't trying to destroy people's personal character. He was remaining faithful in a way that would create the best possible outcome. Now, having said that, as the story continues, we will observe that Daniel not only remained faithful, but exercised significant influence on the godless world around him. And there will be times when his faith will create persecution from this culture. It doesn't always end with them being favorable to him. At least not before there's some singeing going on or some lion spit somewhere. We've got to stop for now. But what I want you to take home with yourself today is just simply this. Daniel's not a book about Daniel. It's a book about Yahweh. It's a book about his sovereign power that uses every means, including exile, to keep his plans and his promises alive and moving forward. It's a book that shows us that God is at work even in those moments when he seems most absent. It's a book that shows us that even in the midst of persecution, God uses his people to influence the culture and to make a difference. But the question is, again, how do we do that? And how do we pick our battles? Christians have always been in exile. Sometimes we've forgotten that. You know, sometimes we think we have the home court advantage. Not any longer. Paul tells us that our citizenship is in heaven. The Bible tells us that the world is not our home. Hebrews. There have been times that the church seems to be the home team, but for now, at least in the West, that time has passed. We are in exile in Babylon. We know this, don't we? Do we know this? Are we in Babylon? Does anybody dispute that? We're in exile in Babylon. The question then becomes, how do we pick our battles? How do we approach our exile? How do we remain faithful? How do we keep our hope? It isn't only daring to be a Daniel. It's reminding ourselves daily that Yahweh's in control. And Jesus is still seated at the right hand of the Father. And we have been sent out to be sheep among wolves. So be innocent and be wise. Be helpful and loving. Be a good citizen like Paul reminds us to do in Romans 13. But always, always, always keep your eyes on Christ. Here's a question for you to pray through this week and answer. It's a two-parter. First, what's the rich food you need to abstain from? Please know I'm not talking about food. Or maybe for some of you it might be, I don't know. What's the one thing that is sucking you into Babylon, is what I'm asking. What's the one thing that's changing your identity from being in Christ to being of the world? What is the one thing that feeds your pride and your self-centeredness? Take your stand against it. Refuse to sit at its table. Second, what's the one thing you need to do daily to remind yourself of the unseen world? What do you need to do to remind yourself that you're not alone and that God is right here with you right now? Despite how you feel. Despite how it looks. What do you need to do to remind yourself that your success isn't found on your looks or your education or your wisdom or your smarts or your bank account? It's simply because God has blessed your life. Worship team.